everyone. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And I noticed something over the years, which is that many people who run consulting companies want to make the transition into selling software. And whenever you hear a company that did it, it seems like it was like that. You already have the team, so they could code it. You already know how to design, so they could design it. It's such an easy transition. And then when you try to do it yourself, you realize it's really hard. And maybe you think that you're doing something wrong, but I think in reality, it actually is harder than most people make it out to be. Which is why I want to have today's guest on. He actually made the leap and he's willing to say, hey, look, it wasn't an overnight success. It didn't just work. We didn't just have the resources. And as a result, everything happened perfectly right. We had some challenges, but we did it, and man, did he do it. And so I invited him here to talk about that transition. His name is Kyle Racky. He is the founder of Proposify. Proposify allows companies to make better proposals faster so they can win more business. We're going to talk about how he made the transition, how he came up with the idea for Proposify, how he got customers. We're going to talk about his year of hell. We're going to talk about the cult he says he was involved with and so much more. And we're going to do it all thanks to two great sponsors. The first will help you hire great developers or designers or MBAs. If you have a consulting company and you need to beef it up with more staff, you get some part-time, full-time, over full-time people from them. It's called TopTal. And the second will help you get more email addresses, more leads, so that you can actually grow sales. And I'll tell you an example of how they did it with a specific company later. They're called Viral Sweep. And I'll tell you about more both of them later and about my contest with Viral Sweep. But first, I want to get in and say, hey, Kyle, good to talk to you.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Andrew.
What was your consulting company? What did you guys do?
We were a pretty generic web design agency. Started back in 2009, and okay. we built websites and did a little bit of online marketing.
And before that, you were doing this stuff on your own, right? You were freelancing. What kind of freelancing did you do?
Yeah, I mean, I took graphic design in community college and then went out, started working in agencies. And then after a couple of years, when I was 24, I went out on my own as a freelancer and just did general web design, put in CMSs, WordPress, the whole, you know, the usual thing.
You told our producer, I knew when I had that job that I was an entrepreneur. That just was for me. What was it about the job or the salary or anything else that made you say, I've got to go into entrepreneurship, even though I have a great job?
Oh, I mean, I don't think I did have a great job. I think I liked what I did, but I didn't like working in the environments that I was. I think I just, you know, I was young too, so I thought I was smarter than my bosses, and I didn't trust their leadership. So I just kind of realized, you know, I wanted to go and do it myself and get my own clients.
Get your own clients. And also you wanted, as I understand it, you said, look, I want to be able to control my own salary. I know that there's a hunger inside me sometimes to go double sales, but I can't do it here because I'm on a salary.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was terrified of selling, but thankfully I had my friend Kevin, who's now my business partner of like 10 years, and he was really good at sales. So he was giving me kind of little tips, but it was a whole new realm for me and I wasn't sure I could do it.
I'm surprised to hear you say that because your background includes a religious organization that knocks on people's doors and does sales.
Mm. Yeah.
What was it?
And maybe, the religion is Jehovah's Witnesses. And I grew up, my parents raised me in that since I was a young lad. It's weekly knocking on doors, and they actually have weekly meetings that teach you how to, they don't call it sell, but how to, you know, teach and overcome objections and all this like classic sales training they kind of instill in you. And so maybe I was afraid of sales because I dreaded the idea of knocking on doors and having people slam them in my face.
Yeah. You know what? Even here in San Francisco, which feels like the least religious city I can imagine, the Jehovah's Witnesses are out there on the street right by BART. How does it even pay off for them? When you're going door to door, do you ever get somebody open the door? Did you ever get somebody to embrace Jehovah's Witness? What is it? Jehovah's Witness, the organization? Do you ever get someone to join?
I didn't personally. Most people don't do like they don't that way. I don't actually. I mean, this could be a whole other topic, but I mean, I don't think Jehovah's Witnesses knock on doors now because they know it's effective. It's the least effective way of converting members. And if you see them over the long period of time, they built their whole organization from the door-to-door work. But lately, in the last 10 years, they've been reducing the amount of publications they print, going mostly online, pointing people to their website. So I think they are trying to get into that. You'll also notice they're at train stations and subway stations now. So door-to-door is very ineffective, but I think they do it to keep the members very busy. That's it.
Just to keep them busy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. So what did you learn about sales from them?
Well, I think one of them is rejection handling, because you are going to be rejected constantly. You have to just be able to not take it personally, not get too upset about it. And I think that's good for any salesperson to know.
What else? Is there something else that stuck with you?
I think the stuff that you would probably learn in sales, like trying to find common ground with people, trying to, even just speaking training, like being able to enunciate clearly or use examples or illustrations, being able to make comparisons. So kind of teaching stuff, all of that stuff is like helpful.
Any of those stand out in your mind? Any comparisons or examples that you would go to whenever you wanted to talk to people? Do you remember any of those?
Not offhand, but I was trained from about 5 to go up and speak in front of the congregation and do talks. And then when I was older, I would do more hour-long sermons and that kind of thing. So you're always being, trying to use comparisons and metaphors and all that kind of stuff, which is, it does capture people's attention and keeps them interested.
I get that. Okay. So even with that, you still had a little bit of hesitation about sales. And then you partnered up with Kevin Springer. Was Kevin going to be doing the sales largely? For this agency that you guys are forming?
For the agency, yeah. Originally, it was just him giving me tips to go out on my own and do my own thing. And then later on, he left the same agency and he's about 20 years older than me. So he had run businesses before in the States, in Florida. And he wanted to go do his own thing as a consulting business. And I just thought, hey, you're really good at sales. Why don't you come join me? So the analogy was, he goes out and fishes, brings home the fish, and I'll cook them up and I'll do the work for the clients and make it great.
I see. Okay. And the agency was called Headspace, which now has a whole other meaning, right? Yeah. Isn't Headspace the app that now lets you do meditation?
It is. It is. Yeah. That wasn't out at the time when I came up with that.
Okay. So you're doing it, you're doing good work, and you think to yourself, I want to get into software. Why? Why not just stick with consulting? What was it about consulting that made you want to switch?
I mean, running a service business is very difficult. You're trading hours for dollars. It also was my first business and I was inexperienced. And so I made a lot of mistakes in terms of how we sold, how we collected payments and just managing cash flow and being able to keep everything.
Let's get specific about one specific mistake that you made. I find that I learn better when I hear one specific example.
Right. I mean, one, I could probably go through a long list. One of them is just being general and just sell, and not doubling down on a niche or going after one specific market. Uh-huh. Just saying we do awesome websites. It worked for a little while, but then it eventually became really hard to stand out and get clients, especially in a place like Nova Scotia where I live, where there aren't that many clients. So you kind of need to go outside into bigger cities, and you can't do that if you don't have any kind of niche specialty.
Why didn't you guys specialize then?
Well, part of it maybe just didn't realize it at the time how important that was, and also afraid to kind of go out and choose a specialty. That was difficult.
I know the feeling. I mean, frankly, even here with Mixergy, sometimes I feel like I'm not specializing enough, and it's hard because whenever I say I want to reach just this audience, I'm also saying I don't want you, even though you're here in the audience. Okay, so you didn't specialize. That was an issue. You're saying something about billing also caused problems for you. What was that?
Just even the way that we broke up billing with clients. So sometimes, for example, we would maybe collect a certain amount at the beginning of a project. So a client says, okay, I want you to do my website. We bill 50%. And that was fine. But then the rest of the project would drag on. The client didn't get us copy. They didn't get us approval. And we would be waiting until we launched the website to bill. So all of a sudden, we've got all these projects stuck in limbo. We're waiting to collect payments. Meanwhile, we still have to pay our salary, our rent, our payroll, that kind of thing. So that we were in cash flow crunch all the time.
I get that. What do you do to solve that? In retrospect, is there anything that you could have done?
If I was to go do it again, and I certainly hope that I never have to go run an agency again. If I were to do it, I would only do retainer-based work, and I would sell upfront discovery projects as a foot-in-the-door project. And then I would only sell monthly retainers at 6 to 12 month contracts.
What's a foot in a door project? How does that work?
So for example, like if a client wants you to build their app and it's going to be this massive project, maybe let's say it's $100,000 project or 500,000, whatever the amount, being the time that it takes to close that deal is very long, because of all the, you know, the proposals and the scope, scoping out of it and whatnot. So it's often easier to sell a small, like say a $5,000 engagement, just to get in the door with them, start planning it, get their, build their trust. And then you can say, okay, here's the plan we gave you. You can go and hire anyone to do that now. And nine times out of 10, they'll pick you to do it.
I see. So the first thing you sell is the plan, and people would pay for the plan?
A lot of agencies give it away at the proposal stage. They'll go up and do this whole plan for free and then get rejected and say, well, we're not going with your proposal. So the easiest way to do that is just sell it as an actual deliverable.
And people will pay for that? They'll pay for the plan that then gets executed by somebody?
Yeah, because it needs to be done anyway. They'll need to pay to have that done even if they start working with you. So it's
But I thought you were saying that they could get it for free, that they won't necessarily need to pay for it.
Well, some are very sneaky and they're able to get, you know, get all these discoveries from multiple agencies and get them to kind of bid against each other. But you know, even if they choose to go working with somebody, they're still going to be that upfront discovery a little bit.
I see. Okay. All right. And I guess that's also good for them because they pay and get to see how you work and get a sense of what it would be like to continue to work with you. So that's one other thing that you would have done. What else? Let's go for one other thing that made you, that turned you off to doing consulting work to the point where now you're saying, I hope I never get back into it.
I think a lot of that comes down to just general scope creep and being able to manage projects effectively and get them done is a huge thing. And also, you know, sales and business development and really being able to, but I guess like a lot of that comes back down to specializing and not just relying on word of mouth and referrals and going to meet with people for coffees who have like a $1,000 job that you just can't take on because you can't make money off of it.
Right. Figuring out who the right customer to spend time wooing is a big thing too.
Exactly.
You know, one more thing about scope creep and making sure the project doesn't expand. What would you do to avoid that?
A lot of that is having really good project managers and being able to know the difference. And this is a mistake that I made, was I thought of an account manager and a project manager as being the same role, the same person, but really I think they're different. A person who's an account manager manages that client and their expectations and the relationship. A project manager, they're actually out there for the agency, trying to make the agency money and make sure that nobody's doing extra work without getting paid. And
so there's a good project manager would say, this is outside the scope of what you signed up for. If you want that, it's going to cost more and it's also going to add more time. But I need to be the disciplinarian who says no when you're asking for more stuff.
Exactly. So you get a healthy conflict between the account manager and the project manager.
I see.
Which we didn't have.
All right. So I get how that would be a really tough tough business to be in. You then said, I want to come up with software. Basecamp was the motivation. The guys who used to run 30, what was called 37 Signals, who now are running just one piece of software, Basecamp. What did you see about them that attracted you to their way of working?
I started really paying attention to Basecamp soon after they came out, and this was before I started an agency. And I always thought, you know, there should be a proposal tool for that, kind of like the Basecamp for proposal management. That was just a very early idea in the early to mid 2000s I had, and I kind of wireframed it in my basement one night. But then I just sat it, I put them in the shelf, and I didn't really look at it anymore. But then as we were running the agency and we were building sometimes SaaS products for other people, for our clients, and we thought, wouldn't it just be really cool if we were a SaaS company and we just had one product and that's what we poured all of our energy into? We got the monthly recurring revenue. That was just the model that attracted us. And we were really good at user experience and building digital products. So we just thought it made sense to kind of build one. And of course, in actuality, building it is a whole other story.
What do you mean? Well, actually, I see how you found this idea, but you put it on the back burner for a bit. You were looking for something. What are some of the other ideas that you were going through when you, even though you had the winning idea somewhere on the back burner, what were some of the other ones?
So the first SaaS tool we built was called Site Tea.
Site Tea.
Like the drink.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was actually before Wix and Squarespace came out, and it was a do-it-yourself website builder, only it sucked. So it became hard for us to get customers, but that was just one idea.
Okay. So what was the problem with that? When you say it sucked, what sucked about it? Because that's a really tough thing to build, right?
Yeah, it really tough. Like technology-wise, it was super MVP. So when we put it out there, it was more or less just installing WordPress sites for you and you, choosing a theme. It wasn't quite as slick as the big ones now. And I also think that we didn't know enough yet about how to do SaaS effectively that we just gave up very quickly. I'm sure maybe if we doubled down and just focused for years on that idea, we might have been able to be a contender. But very early on, we just got a couple customers that didn't stay. We didn't work to get anymore. And then we just gave up on it.
I see. I always like the way that Brian Clark of Rainmaker approached it. He said, we need a better way to create websites for marketers, but I'm not going to write the software myself. I'll take WordPress and customize it. That way, as they update WordPress, my software gets updated, and all I have to do is come up with the unique things that my audience needs. Right?
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
I see the challenge there. All right, before we get into other things that you did, let's take a moment and talk about a company that actually works very well with consultants. It's called TopTal. And I had no idea, by the way, Kyle, that this was the way that many people use TopTal. They have consulting agencies, kind of like you, but they decide that they don't want to hire a big team. They just want to be able to call on TopTal whenever they need to work with them. In fact, I just had dinner with the people who are writing books for with the Book in a Box organization. And this guy sitting next to me, his name was Andrew. So because our names were the same, we struck up a conversation. And I said, what is your book about? And he said, how to build iPhone apps. And I said, okay. What's the premise? He says, well, you hire developers to do it. You hire outside contractors. I said, how you do that? He says, my secret was this company. You probably never heard of them, but they're called TopTal. I said, oh, I know them. He said, yeah. That's what all I did. I would sell the app, and then I'd go to TopTal, hire their developers to build it. I'd make sure the developers did the right job, and then I'd pass it on to the client. I said, why'd you use TopTal when there's so many cheaper agencies? He said, the difference between the best and the second best developer is not like twice as good. They're 100 times as good. You get better results, faster product, and you can actually charge more for it when it comes from TopTal. And so that's this thing. And frankly, a big part of his book is going to be about how people should just be charging clients and then sending the work to TopTal. So if you guys are listening to me and you're running an agency and you need more people, but you don't want to hire more full-time people, or you need some people who are really top guns, guys who are the best of the best, go to TopTal. They pride themselves on screening people out and only ending up with the best of the best in their list. So when a company like yours wants to hire, they will go to their network, find the perfect person for you based on the work that you need, and then they'll match you up with them. Once you get a match, if you're happy, you can start working with the developer often within days. Part-time, full-time, project basis, whatever you need. That's the way TopTal works. Gives you ultimate flexibility, and then they give you the best people to do the job. Here's the URL that will give Mixergy listeners 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when they pay for their first 80 hours. And that, of course, is in addition to the no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. Here's a secret URL just for us. It's toptal.com/Mixergy. Top as in top of your head, tal as in talented, toptal.com/Mixergy. All right. I see the first idea that didn't so much work out. What was the second thing that you tried? What's another idea that you guys tried for creating software?
So the company that most people here have probably heard of called Radian 6, which is a big social media monitoring app, very enterprise level, I think one of the top in the world. And it was actually started by some founders right where I live in Atlantic Canada, over on the eastern side. Mm-hmm. That had recently sold to Salesforce for over $300 million. And so social media monitoring was on everybody's mind. And so we said, hey, why don't we take that approach and make us a version of it for smaller companies, not enterprise, super expensive, very very small market, call it Social Gopher. And it would go and you would put in keywords and it would find where these conversations are taking place all over the internet. And so that's what we built. And the big mistake we made with this was that we didn't factor in data costs. So we got about three customers paying to use it, and then all of a sudden we got shut off by Twitter APIs saying, like, you're using the free, you know, API, you're pulling too much data, so now we're shutting you off. And then we had to look at third-party providers who basically you can plug into their network, which was going to cost thousands and thousands of dollars per month. And we were already bleeding cash as a business anyway. So we quickly realized that's not the thing. And the other thing was, I'm actually really not excited at all about social media monitoring. That's not something that gets me going. I kind of did it because I felt we should, but wasn't passionate about it. I think a huge takeaway for people is to do what gets you excited, not just what you think is going to make money.
What framework were you using, even if it wasn't a clear one, what framework were you using to find these ideas?
So we would sometimes come up with ideas, as everybody does. You know, you're having drinks with your co-founder or with an employee. Oh, there should be an app for that. You know, this is the way it would look. Do a nap. I call it the napkin sketch. And then we just go away and start building. And what we really should have done, that we learned once we got to Proposify, was to actually do customer development and kind of take the lean startup approach and actually try to validate that an idea is worthwhile before spending all the resources to build it.
I see. What about you're just basically saying, here's what the world needs. The guys from Basecamp say that the best way to come up with an idea as a consultant is to ask, what do I need? Not what does the world need, but what do I need? The problem that I have with that approach is I've seen people use it since they've started talking about it. And what happens is it leads to a lot of time tracking SaaS apps, you know, because everyone who's a consultant needs an easier way to track their time. It always sucks to do it. So they create software for it, but it's a niche product. And in the end, the solution isn't better software. The solution is just that it sucks to track your time. And yeah, you can make it a little bit less sucky, but it's always going to suck. So I always wondered, would they still stand by that approach to 37 Signals, now Basecamp, if they looked around at how that was being used today, or did they change since then? Right? Because what do you think?
Ironically, Basecamp, I think they got in a lot of heat when they came out with their version 2 because they got rid of the time tracking feature, which everybody, a lot of people liked, but they were like, we can't, for whatever reason, they cut that feature. And I think that serves a bigger point of what you're saying is when we looked at Proposify, it was writing proposals sucks and we want to make it look really good. So we use InDesign, but InDesign is hard for non-designers to use. The collaboration and all that, and then sending big PDF files and waiting for people to accept them and having to follow up. There was all these problems around proposal management. So we were 100% scratching our own itch. Like, we were taking that Basecamp approach of building something you want that doesn't exist.
I see.
But I think where the change happens is that you can do that and then you can launch it. And then afterwards you start getting customer feedback and you start realizing, okay, you're 80% on the right track, but what the market really needs is this. And then you have to adapt your vision and start building what customers are asking
for. And that's what ended up happening with you. So you tried a bunch of ideas. How did you end up with this one, with what ended up becoming Proposify? How did you know the proposal? How did you reawaken your need to get back into proposal software?
So it came about, we were just maniacs coming up with all these SaaS products and trying them out, even though we really didn't have the resources or time or money to do them all. We were just doing them because, I don't know. And we started the proposal software idea. It wasn't called Proposify at the time, but we found out that locally there was this startup event happening called Demo Camp, where people would go up and pitch their ideas and you had to actually demo the software. So I found out about it like a week before it was actually on, and I applied and got in. And the crappy half-built prototype that we had that was just like stuck together with duct tape, we had to really push to get something that could look like it was in existence, even though it wasn't. And so we did that, and they were literally like developers making changes, 2 minutes before I was to go on stage and present this thing. And I did the demo and I showed how it worked. And when I came off stage, I just had like a flood of people come over to me. That looks so cool. I could use that. I write proposals. And so it was really just the reaction that it got from people that were like, okay, I think we're onto something. Because when we show it to people, they get excited, and that's a good sign.
All right. So 3 months later, you actually came up with a real version 1. What was in that version 1, and how did you decide what features to include?
So again, we started with the MVP was really just what do we want? What would our perfect software look like?
And it was really, just to underline it, it started with what do we want? And then you looked around and you said, look at all these other people. They want it too. Got it. And that's when you said, all right, now let's come back to how we would do it and see if they also want these features too. And so what are some of the features that you would want?
So we wanted something that kind of looked and felt like InDesign and gave you that level of design customization, but you could do it all through a web browser and your, you know, account manager could log in and start writing stuff. That was really where it started. But the funny thing was we put out the MVP and it was just a whimper. It was like, the fart in the windstorm, pardon the analogy, but like nobody cared. They were, customers who were on the waiting list to get it were then emailing me going like, I don't, this sucks. This is way harder to use than anything else. I'm just going to stick to my old way of doing it. So that was really deflating. It was what we launched was really not what the market wanted. And it was going to take a lot longer for us to get the market what they wanted.
What should you have done to avoid that? If you could go back in time to that 3-month period, what would you have done to get that right?
You know, it's funny. I wouldn't change a thing.
Why?
And here's why. One of the biggest things that kind of annoys me is when people are going or they come up to me and they say, I'm a founder of a SaaS company and I really want some advice. And I go, okay, well, did you launch it yet? And go, no, it's been in development for about a year, but we're just waiting to do some things before we launch. I'm like, you can't even begin learning what the market wants until you launch something. I would rather spend 3 months getting something shit to market and then start learning than try to spend a year really anticipating what the market wants before launching it, because you'll never find out.
You're saying, look, it's one thing to have conversations with people to try to understand. It's another thing to put a real product in front of them. And I get that. You know what? Sometimes when I write emails to the audience or blog posts or something, I just stare at the page for a very long time trying to figure out what am I going to say. I write my first sentence, then I write the second. Even if I have a shitty writer put together the first version, it's so much easier for me to say, no, this stinks because, and then the stuff pours out of me. And so you're saying, look, you have 3 months. First of all, you're showing your potential customers that you're willing to invest the time and that you have the ability to create something. And second, you're giving them something to fight against. And they're specifically saying, that is not what we want. We thought you were going to create. And then it gives them something to respond to. Is that right?
You said it better than I could. It's like you have to put the lump of clay, the slab of clay has to be laid down before you can begin chiseling away and turning it into something real. And a lot of people are trying to envision exactly how the sculpture is going to look before they've laid down the clay. I don't think it can be done.
So then tell me about what you created versus what they wanted so that I get a sense of what the difference was.
Okay, there's two, I'd say maybe three big features that we discovered over the course of, I mean, it really took us 17 months from when we launched the MVP to what we call being a product market fit meant for us would have been like doubling our revenue and scaling quickly. Three major things that we learned through the course of just customer development and watching how people they used it and saw what they asked for. So there's three things. The biggest hurdle we had was people went, okay, this looks okay, but I don't want to take the time to have to rebuild my existing proposal in it. We thought a long time how to solve that problem. We thought maybe we actually did just rebuild it for some customers, but we knew that we couldn't do that for everybody. When we launched templates, so when we actually took like our actual proposal template that we were using at Headspace and just came up with a few theme variations and just threw it out there and said, here's a ready to go web design proposal template. We found a massive surge in people just picking their template and customizing it versus trying to rebuild something from the ground up. Templates was the biggest thing that we didn't even think until much later on in the process.
How did you come to that conclusion that templates were so important?
It really just came down to customer development and hearing what people wanted and the hurdle that they have.
What Sometimes was your process people don't for hearing that. You're saying you got on the phone with people who said your stuff stinks and you said, well, what were you expecting?
Yeah.
So yeah, what was the process?
I mean, the process was really, it was kind of crazy because it was me as one of the founders of Headspace, which we were still trying to keep that running. My other co-founder was trying to sell it, keep money in the bank. And I was working with one developer who was just dedicated to just this product, Proposify, Jonathan. He's now our CTO. And he and I would brainstorm how to do things. I would design it. He would build it. And then we would put it out there. And I would take the support emails or I would pick up the phone and call customers. It was primarily me doing all of that customer development work. And it was really just talking to people.
I'm looking at an early version of your site now as you're describing it, and it actually looks like it has all these features. I'm looking at one from December 2014. So that's fairly fast. You launched in 2014, right?
No, we launched in April 2013.
So maybe the site had a different name. Now it's proposify.biz.
Yes. At the time, it was actually Pitch Perfect, and that was before the movie came out. So once the movie came out, people started getting it confused, and we were like, ah, it's a sucky name anyway.
Pitchperfect.biz?
Pitchperfectapp.com was what it was.
Got it. Okay. All right. I'll have to go back and look at that. Meanwhile, you're still trying to run your business, as you said. What about the whole idea that, hey, if you've got a consulting company, you have a team of people in their spare time, they could code up the app as you need it and you can take your time building it. That's not possible, huh?
I'm sorry it cut out there for a little bit. I guess hear what you said.
You had to have a full-time person work on this, which basically is like running a whole startup. You didn't get any of the advantages of having a team of developers, designers, et cetera, right? Why not?
Yeah,
why doesn't that theory hold up, which is you run a consulting company, you have all the staff, just use their spare time?
I mean, that's a great question, because in the past when we were building these SaaS products, we thought of it as a project. It was like a developer has five projects on their plate and they've got to work on them all sort of different days. We realized really quickly that if you do that, you will never get your product to market, because when a developer suddenly at Friday morning picks up the SaaS product and begins working on it, and he or she has had four other days of projects, they have to take time to get reacquainted with the code and start looking at it. And then suddenly it's the end of the day and okay, I won't work on it for another week. It's going to take decades to get to where you need to be. You need a dedicated developer to work on it, and that is their thing. That's all they do, and you don't have project managers coming at them and saying, we want changes done for this client. That's it. That's the only thing they have to do, and they're fired if they work on anything else.
You know what? I remember asking Mike McDermott in the early days of FreshBooks, what's the point of having invoicing software? You can just go into Microsoft Word. Even that old piece of software has an invoice template. Can't you just go create it and send it out? And he said, you obviously have not sent out that many invoices. And the more I sent out invoices, the more I realized, yeah, you could send it that way, but then you need an easy way for people to pay. And then also you need to remember that if they don't pay, that you need to send reminders. And if they do pay, you stop the reminders, right? So already you've gotten a little bit too complicated. And it's hard to charge people who you've just been working so in such a friendly basis. So there's like the head issues that go along with that, right? I want to ask you the same question. I'm setting that up so that you know I'm not being dismissive of the need, but what is the challenge with proposal software? Can't you just go in and type it up and send it out?
That is what a lot of people do traditionally. I mean, that's what you do. You go into Word, you write your proposal, and you email it, or you make a PDF and you email it. There's a few problems that we identified. Was one of them is if you write a lot of proposals, just like with invoices, how do you see a snapshot of all the invoices, when they're due, how much they're for, what are waiting to be collected? Just managing the actual bulk of it all is really difficult. And that's hard to do with Word, even with Google Docs, because you can use folders and it just gets complicated really fast. And the other thing is the delivery method of the client. So a client gets this 10 meg or whatever PDF in their inbox and they open it. You have no idea if they open that attachment or where they looked in it. And then it comes down to, you know, it's time to sign this. Now, what am I going to do? They have to print it out, sign it, fax it to you, take a picture with their phone. Like, there's just so much there that with our system or with any proposal software, you can send a link to the client. They view it in the browser. It looks really nice. And then they can just sign it digitally, like on their phone or in the browser. So it's just taking that all the time consuming stuff that usually sucks with proposals and shortening it and making it easier.
Were your first clients web designers like you guys?
Mostly, yeah. That was the audience. And I want to make this point that we learned from the mistakes at the web design agency of not specializing, where when it came time to what we were doing, even though a lot of people write proposals and need things signed, we learned that you need to carve down a niche and do what you know. And we knew web design and digital marketing agencies really well. So all the content that we could create, all the marketing was strictly aimed at agencies. We even had investors and other people saying, why are you being so specific? This could be used by anybody. And we were like, no, we need to own a market first and then later on start looking at broadening out.
Okay. All right. Let me take a moment to tell people about a contest that I'm running, and you guys can see it at mixergy.com/win. And I know it's kind of weird for you, Kyle, to hear that I'm doing a contest here and for the audience to hear it. Partially I'm doing it with the prize of like this stand-up desk that I really love. I've been on a stand-up desk and I have a stool to sit down when I want to, but the ability to stand up while I'm in conversations really helps. It's hard to sit all day. I've been loving these earbuds, the AirBuds actually from Apple. Makes it so much easier to have conversations, especially while standing up, to listen to podcasts, etc. I'm including that. So the question is, why am I even doing a freaking contest? And the answer is, well, one of the answers is a company called Avelo. I don't even know what this company is freaking called, how to pronounce it, but here's what I do know about it. They ran one of these viral contests where they ended up getting 2,397 emails collected. And I realized, wait, that's actually a significant number of email for a company that makes electric bicycles. I said, interesting. It's always helpful to have more people on an email list. They also got a whole bunch of shares, like 476 shares on Facebook, 360 tweets, the works, right? That's a little less relevant. But the main number that really got me excited was 39,912. That's how much money they made from this contest. Meaning they ran a contest where they gave away an electric bike, which is what they sell, and a couple of other things that go along with it, like a chain to keep people from stealing it. They ended up collecting a good number of email addresses, 2,300 email addresses. And then when they went back to that list and said, hey, you entered to win this bike. One of you won, but the rest of you didn't. Would you like to buy the bike? Since you didn't win it and you're excited enough to enter, they sold $39,912 worth of it. And so we're having a contest where we're offering this desk and a bunch of other things, including Mixergy Premium. And if you want to win it, you go over to mixergy.com/win. And this whole contest is put together by the same piece of software, the same company that put together that electric bikes contest. It's called Viral Sweep, and you'll see information about it if you go to mixergy.com/win. And what I like about them is that they don't just leave you with the site and hope that you're going to get it right. They know that the world has way too many contests. If you're going to actually have a contest that delivers real leads and email addresses, real sales, meaning people are actually going to buy from you, and real shares and the rest, you need a platform and a group of people who are going to help make it work right. And that's what Viral Sweep is about. Not just software. You can buy a bunch of different software for running contests, but the works, including things like here. This was what stopped me from running a contest in the past. I don't know what the terms of service should be. Am I going to go hire a freaking lawyer to do it? And every time I go to someone who runs a contest, they say, I just copied it from somewhere. So am I going to copy some idiot's contest who copied it from someone else who maybe it's going to get me in trouble? I don't think so. I want all those little details taken care of. And that's what Viral Sweep will do. They take care of all the little details so that overall you have a package and a contest that just works right. So do what I'm doing. Go check it out. I'm with Viral Sweep. I urge you guys to check them out. They're a good sponsor. They just came on recently. And we have our contest up with them. See my contest first so that you get a sense of how they work. And then check out Viral Sweep if you want to do it for yourself. So the URL again is mixergy.com/win. Win is in the three letters. Go win something. Win this desk. Win the earpods. The AirPods. I keep calling them AirPods. They're AirPods. Right? I wish Apple would just get a little more creative with their names. Right? So get these AirPods, which are fantastic, get the stand-up desk, and get Mixergy Premium, where you'll learn from proven entrepreneurs, and you'll get content that's not available here as part of the regular podcast feed. Mixergy.com/win, and I'm really proud to say that it's created by Viral Sweep, this great platform and team of people who help make contests work. Mixergy.com/win. I always like to end the ad with the actual like call to action. Mixergy.com/win. But sometimes I can't stop yapping.
You're a pro.
Thank you. Yeah, you know what? I have to say, my early interviews, I would read the ads live and I would freaking suck. And then I would call myself out on it. And people would say, oh, Andrew, you shouldn't beat yourself up. I'm not beating myself up. I'm calling it out. If I have the guts to say to a guest, hey, you're not giving me a good enough answer, then I shouldn't have the same guts to say, hey, I suck right now, but guess what, guys? I'm going to suck in public, and are you going to watch me keep improving and improving? And man, we've actually more than doubled our ad prices. I think it's like 10x our ad prices as I've gotten better and better at this. Wow. All right. I love that. You know what? I don't know about you, Kyle. I love doing something and then coming back the next day and the next day and the next day and keep working at getting better at it. You feel like that too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's the only way to succeed, really. Everybody, I think it stops people from trying things because they know I'm not good right now, but it's like when you learn a musical instrument, like you have to be cool with the fact that you're just going to suck for like years before you even start getting good.
Yeah. And the times in my life where I wasn't ever getting good and making progress is where I didn't feel comfortable sucking. I didn't feel comfortable being a bad runner who ran out of breath. I remember running in New York, my breath would get cold and I would feel like, well, that sucks. I'm not enjoying it. And so I didn't get to experience it. I didn't feel with dating, like, I don't want to be a bad kisser. I don't know why I got that in my head, that if I'm a bad kisser, then it means that no one should ever be with me. And so I was afraid to suck at little things like that. So I
practice on your hand.
Sorry?
Just got to practice on your hand. You know, the hand doesn't judge.
You know what? If I believed that, I would have done it. yeah. Thankfully, I got out of my head about that and I got much better. All right. It turns out a lot of people are bad kissers and it works out fine.
Too much tongue and saliva.
Yeah. Or not enough engagement in the kiss. You know, like it takes a little while for us to catch each other's rhythm. And frankly, part of being in a relationship is liking the person so much that when your kissing styles are a little bit off, you're okay with it, and having the comfort with the person to signal to them, either with your body language or with words, this kissing style is not for me. I need you to do this other thing. And all right.
It's true.
Sorry?
I said very true. I didn't think we were going to go there, but awesome.
When you were a Jehovah's Witness, were you allowed to date as much? Were there any restrictions there?
Actually, you can sort of date, but it's always with the goal of getting married very quickly. You're not supposed to just date to date. So I was married at 20 years old.
20 years old. Did you feel ready to be married?
Oh, when you're in that religion, you're in sort of a bubble. So all your friends are getting married at 20. It doesn't seem that odd to you. And then later on, after everybody's divorced, then they're like, oh, yeah, that was really stupid. We all got married at 20. Of course, it's not going to work.
And you got into, the relationship got really tough just as the business was starting to get tough. When was this? What was going on in the business and what was going on in your relationship?
So it was, the year was 2012. And I mean, the marriage was quite tumultuous through for a long time. In fact, the divorce still hasn't gone through. As of this recording, it's like just at the tail end.
5 years since then. When you say it was tumultuous, what do you mean? What was happening?
You know, I don't want to slam my ex publicly.
Slam yourself then.
Well, it was all her fault, but no. I will say that everything regarding the personal life in 2012 was very very difficult. My second son was born, and my wife and I at the time broke up very soon afterwards. So it's hard enough to have a baby. Also, my son was born a month after my father died. He was diagnosed with liver disease about a year before that, and then just quickly deteriorated. This was also while the business was running out of cash, and we were very stressed financially. And to top it all off, I think my dad dying sort of was a catalyst for me looking at material that was considered apostate by Jehovah's Witnesses. You're not supposed to read any literature or any websites by ex-members. And I did that. And then I quickly realized and woke up that I was in a cult my entire life. And
what was it that you looked at that made you think, this feels cult-like to me, I've got to get out?
Well, there's different websites, the most prominent of which, if people are interested in this, is they can go to jwfacts.com. And also jwsurvey.org. And both of those really spell out all the beliefs of Jehovah's Witnesses.
So I'll be honest with you. I don't know anything about Jehovah's Witnesses, except they seem like nice people who are standing on the street who are not getting any results and still are committed, which I kind of admire. Other than that, I don't know Jack. So, and I keep looking it up in Wikipedia, remembering it, and then I forget what they're about. What if you could just sum it up, what are they about? And then what was it that the JW Facts told you that made you think, this is not for me?
Sure. So I'm going to try to put this in a very quick mouthful. But first of all, JWs are generally nice people. The people within the religion, I think, are just misled. The organization came about, it really started in the 1800s, and it didn't kind of become Jehovah's Witnesses per se until around 1930 by a guy named Rutherford. And he was sort of the one that transformed it into what it is today. It's very kind of an apocalyptic group. The reason they're knocking on your door is to convince everybody that they need to become a Jehovah's Witness in order to survive Armageddon, which is going to happen any minute now. They actually proclaimed that the end was going to come on several dates in the past and were wrong about it. And then if you actually talk to them now, nobody really remembers that. And the organization and the leaders try to claim that they never said a particular date, even though you can actually go and look it up and find where they said it. So it's an apocalyptic group for sure. And it was really those failed prophecies that was sort of what woke me up to actually look in their past literature and see what they actually wrote. Was a massive wake-up call, because they're always trying to whitewash history and pretend it didn't happen.
What about, I'm just quickly breezing through Wikipedia's entry, there was an issue with child sex abuse, any of that?
Yeah, I didn't know, and most of the members don't know about it because they're shielded again from the leaders in the group, but there's been thousands of cases, very similar to the Catholic Church, all over the world, where children were abused by members, and then when they brought it to the leaders in the church, they tried to cover it over. They disfellowshipped people who went to the police, and so now there's been multiple cases. The most prominent of which is Candace Conti. If you look her up, that was a few years ago, where she actually won in a judgment against against the organization for their role in covering over the abuse.
I see. Candace Conti versus Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of New York Incorporated. I see it. Okay, so that meant that you lost your dad, your marriage was falling apart, you at the same time were finding that this faith that you're born with, that you went to evangelize for, was actually not what you thought it was, and so you were losing that. I wonder how you can work during that, because I know there was a period in my life where all that mattered to me was making money. And if something like this came up, it would be a no-brainer for me. I work through it all, because who cares about everyone else or anything else? The only way to succeed is to stay focused on this. Today, I'm a little bit more open to the fact, well, I've got kids, and so I can't say screw it to everything except for work, because I should take care of my kids, and I love spending time with them. And so that becomes a bit of an issue. And then I care more about the people in my life. So it becomes more of a question, how much time do I dedicate to my work versus how about I just let go of all of work for now, focus on what's important, family, faith, etc., and maybe get a job. How did you decide? What was your framework for deciding what to do?
I think work has always been a welcome distraction for me. I always loved working, especially when I was working on my own businesses. It was easy for me to stay up until 4 a.m. working and, just as the saying goes, hustling and all that stuff. It was very distracting when I was going through the whole leaving the JWs because of the shunning that was involved, where none of the existing members are allowed to talk to you, even if they see you on the street.
Wow.
Family, friends, anybody will, like, you're literally cut off. It's like as if you
just
don't
exist.
Just because
you leave the faith.
Yeah, that's a teaching. Like, that's actually instructed. They're not allowed to talk to you anymore. So I haven't spoken to my sister in 5 years, for example. That definitely is distracting, on top of the fact that you're sort of I had to reevaluate everything about what I believed. I was instilled with this belief that I was going to live forever on earth, and the end, Armageddon was going to come at any moment. And then when suddenly that's shaken up and you just realize you're in a cult, it just messes with your head. And so there was definitely a year of like going to therapy and going on community websites of other ex-members and just trying to process it all. Was time consuming. And so it was really distracting. Like, I'm trying to work and build this business and keep it running, but also discover like who I even am. It was tough.
So you're still working through that? Or at that point in your life, you're really just letting it go?
At this point, it's been 5 years, and there's a term
at the time. Were you still working on your software, on your ideas, on your business, on your clients' work?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was working all the time, and any minute that wasn't spent in work, it was like going on the XJW forums and reading posts
and
reading
posts.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was also the worst time for the business, and I'm sure some of that had to do with my own distractions.
Okay. And your partner, did he give you a hard time about that?
No, we were both in the same, we were both in the same boat. We both made mistakes. And I think we were both working okay. on what we should have been.
All right. So you finally then get clear on what you're doing. You find your the right software. Personally, things aren't set, but they start to get a little clearer so that you can focus more on business. You end up with this grant from the government of Nova Scotia, right? Was that for Proposify or was that for your consulting business, Headspace?
No, that was for, that was a grant to hire a developer to actually work on Proposify.
Oh, really? So they, why would they give you money to work on software?
Well, in Canada, as most people know, you pay a lot more tax, and a lot of that goes into naturally the government. So there's programs that you can take advantage of. There's more government money. And one thing that they try to do, especially in Atlantic Canada, where we're the smaller provinces, we don't make up a lot of their GDP. So they're constantly trying to pump money into the economy to get businesses going, to stimulate small business growth. And so they like people from ACOA, which is what they were called, Atlantic Canada Opportunities Agencies. They liked what we were doing in our approach. And so they decided to give us some funding.
How'd you find out about them? I've interviewed several people who got funding from nonprofits, from government agencies. I would never even think to look. Those people are not on AngelList. They're not blogging to try to get your attention. How'd you find out about it?
In the business community in Halifax, Nova Scotia, I mean, they're just really well known. I think a lot of people want ACOA funding and they just can't get it because maybe they're a consulting business or they're not the type of business they invest in. But anywhere you go in the business community here, people know about ACOA.
Okay. All right. So you got some money to help develop the software. You decide you're going to sell your agency so that you can pay off some debt and, again, focus on your software because you couldn't do both at the same time and have each benefit from the other. How did you sell your agency?
It started with Kevin just kind of going and having conversations with people and trying to, you know, see who was in the market to buy. We had a few conversations, and then we found this these two guys who said they were going to buy the business. And it was like 10 months of hell between just getting beaten down in price, going through lawyers. The whole process was just a nightmare of trying to, and we were trying to keep the business afloat to not lay off any staff, even though we really couldn't afford them. And, you know, try to raise money for the startup. So it was just a very long, arduous process of just trying to get the business sold.
And then in 2014, you joined Volta Pitch Competition. You showed off what you were working on and how far you'd come with it. And you actually got an investor to get excited about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had just on a whim signed up for this pitch competition to show kind of what we've been doing the last 10 months. And it was really just an excuse to get out of the house because I'd broken my foot that year. I was just miserable. And I went and did the pitch and I won this pitch competition between like three people. The judges, you know, gave me the award or whatever. But what was really cool is there was a guy in there from Innovacore, which is a early stage VC, but it's also provincially funded through through the government in Canada. And they looked at us a year ago, didn't think we were quite ready. But then somebody from there said, you know, it looks like you guys are really just doing it. Like you're getting customers, you're growing it. So now we can definitely look at getting some funding. And, you know, that was what happened. We pitched the board and we got the 200, you know, 250,000 sounds kind of funny because it's such a small amount usually by most startup standards. But when we were just dying, you know, 250,000 went a long way.
Yeah.
We made it
and
go a long way.
It shows that they're supportive and someone with money believes in you enough to put their money in the business. But still, you are still not finding product market fit. You're still churning through customers. Sean Ellis was on here. He's a longtime friend of Mixergy who said he has a survey that he likes to show people. I forget what that survey is. It's something like
product market fit survey.
Yeah. I forget the question. It's something like how pissed would you be if this service went away, right?
How would you feel if you could no longer use this product? Disappointed, somewhat disappointed.
And you said, I'm going to put that up. And you started asking people that question. And what happened?
Yeah, so it was late 2014. We saw a spike of, we went from just under $1,000 in MRR to suddenly doubled it in 1 month and then doubled it again the next month. And so we saw this massive spike in customers and MRR growth. And I was afraid to put out the survey because I didn't want to be proven that like people don't care about this product. I was shell-shocked still. And I decided to put it out in something like December. And when I put it out there, Sean Ellis says that the baseline of, you know, you need to have at least 40% of your customers say, I would be very disappointed if I could no longer use the product. And when I put the survey out there, 60% of people said they would be very disappointed if they could no longer use it. And one person even threatened to fly to Nova Scotia and kick our asses if we took it offline.
And the way you got from where you were before, which is a lot of churn, hardly any customers, to suddenly more customers, enough to sustain a business, and that kind of passion was calling up your customers, understanding what they liked about the software, more importantly, what they hated about it, starting to focus on the software so that you could improve it and adding the features that they were looking for, like templates, like signatures and pre-designs. How did that help the business, allowing people to sign?
I mean, that was huge too. People wanted it, and sort of more competitors were offering it as well. Also being able to see metrics like where people looked in the proposal and when they opened it and how long they looked. I mean, those things all together, just there's never one thing. It's always multiple things. But once you just get it where it's now it's easy to use and it's stable and it works and it's solving the problem for people, and it's pretty incredible how fast it spikes.
You had an investor send you a bottle of champagne and told you don't open it. Why did he send you the bottle of champagne?
Yeah, he sent a 1 million ARR bottle of champagne on it. And so once we hit 1 million ARR, we were able to open it. And we didn't hit that until just last year, March or so, 2016.
In $1 million annual recurring revenue, meaning people are paying upfront for a year and you have $1 million in recurring revenue?
People are paying a mix between monthly and annual, but if you total it all, so if somebody pays you $100 a month, then that's, you know, 1200.
I see. The recurring run rate is $1 million.
Yeah.
Which is phenomenal. Do you remember the day when you drank it?
Yeah, we have a little video of us opening up the bottle and down to the minute when we got that $1 million.
You're all watching the dashboard internally.
The whole team was sitting there watching the dashboard to hit it, and then we got you know, 999, $1 away from it. And then somebody canceled and it went down. And then anyway, once it hit everybody, we took a little video of us opening the champagne and cheering.
We just went through all this in 55, 57 minutes. How long did it take to go from the idea that you finally were ready to launch, not backburnering, to the $1 million in annual recurring revenue?
10 years,
Seriously?
9 years, maybe.
No, how about, you launched in 2013 though, right?
Well, when you said the idea really was 2007.
2007. And what about when you said we're going to build that first version for the contest and take it out there for the demo camp?
That was in 2012. And it still wasn't built. It was just a prototype. And then 2013, we actually launched an MVP, and then another 17 months, so late 2014, hitting product market fit.
17 months to product market fit, meaning people actually enjoy the product, 17 months after you launch it, and then from the day you launch the actual product to the $1 million in annual recurring revenue, how long?
About 3 years.
3 years. Wow. And I've got all this I love your stats. You sent us so many stats. You sent us screenshots of how much revenue you're making per membership level. You sent us traffic, which I don't know what you're doing, but suddenly your traffic is jumping up. Let's just get to the bottom line as a way of ending it. You didn't just hit 1 million in annual recurring revenue and then flatline. You've grown since then. Where are you today, a few months after that $1 million mark?
As of this recording, we are coming up on 3 million in annual recurring revenue.
So
So we've actually grown almost by 2 million in the year since we hit the 1 million.
And overall revenue for 2016, what was that?
That was, I believe, 1.5 million.
Okay. And how are you getting all these customers? I know I should end it actually on the number, which is an upbeat way to send people off. But what are you doing to get customers?
Organic search has historically been the biggest way that we get customers. People searching for proposal software, proposal templates, specific proposal templates, blog articles around topics like how to not kill your cash flow in your agency, how to write an executive summary, very special kind of niche long tail keywords, and just overall brand building. Again, it goes back to building a product people love and want, and then getting your customers to then become your advocates and tell people about it and write reviews and ratings on
reviews
different
and
platforms.
Ratings where?
Places like Capterra, GetApp, There's a few other ones.
GetApp. Okay. All right. Congratulations on all the success. The website is proposify.biz for anyone who wants to check it out. And the blog, where's the blog? Since you guys write really good stuff about collecting and charging.
It's proposify.biz/blog. And then we've got articles and a podcast and YouTube videos and whatnot.
Easy enough. Cool. And if you guys are out there running a consulting company or any kind of software company where you need really good developers or designers, TopTal prides itself on getting the best of the best. Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. And if you want to see my experiment to grow my audience, to get my subscriber count up and to sell, I want you to check out my contest, which is at mixergy.com/win. And maybe you'll win a stand-up desk like the one I'm at, these ear AirPods that I freaking love, and a collection of things, which also, it's basically the Mixergy office and Mixergy premium, which will help you grow your business. Go check it out at mixergy.com/win, because I want you to win. And that is created for us by our sponsor, Viral Sweep, which I'm really grateful to for setting this whole thing up. That's what they do. They could do it for you guys too. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Thanks, Kyle. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for having me.